funding, for example, on commodity assisted bribes, another on enterprise flash, maybe one with PCI Express based flash. And then run different workloads, starting from something simple like micro workloads, and then maybe go to replaying the traces, or just running some application level, more sophisticated benchmark, and see what is the performance and where are the bottlenecks. And the way we wanted to do that, we wanted to collect even more traces at the different levels of the clustered file system. So kind of at the block layer, in the file system itself, whatever events happen there related to metadata, to data. And then based on these traces, perform their analysis and figure out where are the problems and if there are any problems. And then the next step is how can we actually solve this problem and optimize this some existing file system for running on Flash. And maybe even, maybe do some modifications that are not rewriting the complete file system from scratch, of course. These were the kind of the steps that we wanted to take to achieve the high-level goal.
So as part of that, I don't know if you remember Vasily. I think I mentioned Vasily's T2M papers in FAST about converting traces of file systems into like file bench programmable algorithmic benchmarks, like micro benchmarks or things like macro benchmarks. So we actually wanted to leverage that. So I think one of the first steps in this is to extend his framework where, it's taking in traces and analyzing them. And the goal in those papers was to take that information and, develop statistical properties such that you could then replay it, in a benchmark. Here, I think we want to do is maybe take the information from the analysis of the traces and do other things with it, right? So now analyzing, how the I/O profile is changing with Flash, or how the networking, we could extend it to looking at, the networking communication or, the I/O from, let's say, the file system level down to the block layer, how that transformation is occurring. So I guess what I'm trying to say is I think using the trace analysis tool that he already has, we can kind of extend it to help sort of learn about what's happening in the system. I think it's a good base that we already have, just sort of something we can build upon.
Right.
In that sense, because we had kind of thought as background, we sort of wanted to look into this all Flash stuff because this is something that's, being hit on my head about how IBM wants to sell more Flash. I guess they have high margins on it. And so they're trying to figure out, okay, well, where are the advantages of it and whatnot. And so we, in GPFS and various other systems, are thinking, well, in order to work well in all Flash, right? I mean, do we need to convert ourselves into a log structured file system? Does all Flash arrays, like these expensive boxes and various other things, mitigate enough of the cost in the FTL layer such that we don't need to change our behavior and we can kind of keep doing the same thing, but we'll get great performance? And so we kind of had that ideas, and then we had, well, we really like this trace framework and being able to analyze and look at the statistical properties of what's going on in traces. So we thought, well, this is a perfect opportunity to kind of, merge those two and use, there might be other, you might have suggestions on how to move forward, but that we thought would be a nice way to kind of use SSDs and all Flash systems as a use case for sort of extending the abilities of this trace analysis framework.
Right. Okay. It does to me. The one thing which I do want to bring up is that it would be good to have some kind of more concrete hypothesis, which we are planning to evaluate with all of this tool building. I see this exercise that you are describing more as a tool building exercise. And it would be good to have that tool building exercise be more more specific in some sense to evaluating a hypothesis that could potentially lead to a research paper. I think that would really I think fill in the gap that I have, at least based on the description. And I sort of understand, perhaps it's too early, but there is a risk of, you know, when we collect too much data and start analyzing it, there is a risk of, and we, out of personal experience, I'm saying this, which is that there is a risk of getting lost in the data and eventually, the whole project dragging too long. So if there's a more focused starting point, I think that would help us a lot. And there are some specific questions that I see in the bullets, which I think are oriented towards that. But there are many of them, right? So I'm just wondering which of these which of these bullets you would like to explore more specifically. That would give us a good focused direction to discuss any kind of tool building that you would get started.
Right. No, definitely. And that's kind of where I was those bullet points there that I sent you, they're more of brainstorming, throwing everything against the wall, right?
Right. Yeah. I think more specifically, it would be good to have some new insights, as something fairly fundamental that we can sell in a paper.
Exactly. Well, and the thing is too is, as you had your, I saw the the paper you had on your write back caching a couple of years ago, or was that last year? And there, there's SCMFS. There's a lot of sort of what we're trying to do is, and this is something we would want to, like you were saying, shape before the summer, is carve that niche, right, and answer the specific problem, I think, that's related to the networked and distributed aspect of the system, as well as, I think, the use of, we could get into doing comparisons of different types of flash, but I think one of the original thoughts I had was, if you use sort of the higher end flash, the really expensive SSD stuff, does that kind of mitigate
the right performance.
Sorry, go ahead.
The right performance issue. You're talking
And does it create, does the use of that, which I think hasn't been explored as much, most of it's been around commodity junk, and so the, or single node access in terms of you know, you're not getting a lot of distributed access into the same set of data, as well as you're not getting, you know, the whole striping, right? The whole concept of how multiple, you know, we're not talking about single here. We're talking about many of them combined together in a much bigger setup. So you're right. We've kind of been brainstorming ideas, but in that area, we're trying to figure out, okay, how to carve out, you know, something, a hypothesis for a paper that would be, you know, something that's novel.
And Vasily should speak, I guess.
Well, I just wanted to, so I completely agree with you that, you know, we need something more specific because that's the only way to succeed in the short time that, you know, we have in the summer, and then, you know, maybe there will be a little bit after the summer, but still, the only way to succeed in a short time is to have a specific idea. Right now, we don't have any, and I guess one of the goals of this meeting today is to try to, you know, initiate that kind of brainstorming and figure out one specific idea to focus on. So one specific hypothesis that I'm curious about, and again, it's not like I'm saying we should do that, it's just like a suggestion maybe to discuss, is that if we look at the modern storage servers that are used in these clustered file systems, they use GPUs that have a lot of cores, they're very high performance, and they have high frequencies. And still, these old, relatively old storage servers, they have disk drives that are relatively slow. So there should be something behind the logic of the designers of the system that they still put this very fast CPU still the storage is small. Now, we replace the disk drive by SSD, so logically, you know, CPU utilization goes higher, and now should we actually add extra cores, or should we add more even higher, better CPUs in the storage node? And so this is one hypothesis, and the answer is probably yes if we do not change the hardware. Now, or maybe we can actually change if we do not change the software. Sorry. Or should we? How can we change the software that now we can use the same CPUs without adding too many cores, but with flash? So, was I more or less clear? Was this idea more or less clear to you?
Yeah. So you're saying, okay, your hypothesis more specifically is that there is a need for change in either the hardware or software because the underlying properties of the storage has changed significantly. That's the hypothesis, right? And ideally, assuming that the system was balanced previously and you're changing one of the endpoints, you would have to rebalance the whole thing. That's
exactly,
the source of the hypothesis, right?
Right. And one more player that should be mentioned here is that there is a network in the cluster file system, so that rebalancing needs to be done, taking that third player in the account as well.
Right. So that I think that's a reasonable hypothesis to start thinking about. We need to then the next step, which I like to take, is to design some, you know, first draft of an experiment that we can use to evaluate the hypothesis, right? To say that okay, here's a setup that will allow us to conclusively and comprehensively decide whether this, you know, this hypothesis makes any sense, right? If we can come up with that piece as well, then we have a hypothesis that's worth exploring, right? I would say that's certainly something to think more about. From a software standpoint, it's very attractive, at least the way I see it. It's because you are thinking about, well, redesigning potentially the storage stack on the storage server, given that now you have a, a significantly different storage device. The hardware side, it's a cost issue, right? If we add more cores, there is more cost, so you're not getting something for nothing. Whereas the software, you have that, you know, attraction, which is you can potentially get something for nothing, because it's just software. I mean, ignoring development cost. So yeah, I think it's something worth exploring.
That's actually an interesting building on that thought as well. That, you know, you looked at it as from a single node level, but I would say that it could affect the overall system as well. In that, you know, so assuming the balance changes within a single server, does that now mean as well that more or less servers are required, you know, to accomplish the same task? That's what, in the sense of if, you know, if a single server before could only do X, and now it can do much greater than X, but maybe it's limited in terms of, you know, yeah, CPU power or capacity or something, that may mean that the systems may need more or fewer, right, of these servers to accomplish the same, you know, set of work.
Right.
Which I think is a, it just expands, I'm just expanding out the, again, trying to decide on the harsh nature of the problem, you know. So once you change that element in one thing, considering there's clients and metadata servers and server data servers and things like that in the architecture, you know, now you may have caused a rebalance in the whole thing that requires, you know, different ratios of one to the next.
Right. I think that's certainly a valid follow-up hypothesis. The first hypothesis is somewhat independent of the architecture, which is that it could be a clustered file system or it could be a single storage server. I guess I'm not sure if the hypothesis remains the same for that one node instance. I can't see how it's significantly different, going to be significantly different depending on what the architecture is. The second one, the follow-up one, certainly depends on the architecture, right? Because you are assuming metadata servers and such.
Right, right. So this is why we were thinking to maybe, just for the sake of discussion, maybe we should try to run the experiment. Maybe we should try two different file systems that have significantly different design in terms of how they store and distribute metadata, for example.
Okay. So here you're talking about the second hypothesis, right?
Yeah.
Not the first one. Okay. I don't know. I feel the first hypothesis more. You know, it comes earlier than the second hypothesis. And it's to me it seems a little bit more easy to think about. In the beginning, I mean, once we have an answer to the first hypothesis, then it makes sense to start thinking about the second one. And that also helps because the first hypothesis is arguably simpler to evaluate because you have fewer players, fewer elements that get to vary, and you're not talking about a distributed system, so I don't know. This thing that the first hypothesis is in somehow more attractive, at least for in the first step.
The one thing I'll say to Silly on that thing is that I know we haven't gotten into the politics yet. One politics is that in the comparison of these file systems, is you have to be very careful on how we do any comparison with actual products.
you know, the silver bullet, the best outcome would be an optimization that applies to every file system out there.
Yeah, exactly.
So it has.
Well, and that's where, so we're just going through hypothesis or whatever, basically through that list that I had sent. So there's a guy in our department that does all these performance evaluations. And, you know, he is basically saying in a lot of cases that network latency is becoming so low, especially with InfiniBand, that, you know, the general concept of, you know, network communications, basically the overhead of network communications is going down. So whether or not you're accessing data locally or remotely, it's not that big of a deal, I guess, is the point. So I think in terms of that, I think there's like to sort of take that into the flash area anyways. So, you know, is that, I think that that's kind of an interesting question about, is that true, right? So now we're talking about networked flash, and so you get all the benefit of the flash, but then, you know, in order to actually read from it, you gotta go, you know, over a network hop anyways. So, you know, are you really gaining all the benefits that you could, or is you know, are you losing something in the fact that, you know, you have this great fast device, except, you know, since you have to hop over one or two network hops anyways, you know, are you really benefiting? But then, two, I think, you know, cluster file systems anyways, like GPFS, you know, we're notoriously chatty. And so that's where I think I put in there that, you know, what, so today, for example, our distributed lock manager really doesn't get in the way 99% of the time. Yet, you know, that's when we're talking about big streaming I/O, right? And we're talking about types of data access where, you know, the network communication is dwarfed by the massive amounts of data, or, you know, the basically the slow latency of disks. Whereas now, you know, maybe that balance has changed, and I'm curious, again, as another hypothesis, you know, does this mean, you know, again, back to, are you really leveraging the advantages of flash in that, you know, does the role of network communication basically start taking over where, you know, you are basically, it becomes a bigger bottleneck than in the past?
Mm-hmm.
That's a little bit harder one to justify or to think, but I think that it could be easily, you know, constructed to say, well, you know, before network overhead consisted of, you know, X, Y, Z to do X set of tasks, and now when we, you know, do the measurement, it's now, you know, a larger percentage or something like that.
Right.
Anyways, I don't know if that's not interesting, that's fine, but it's kind of something from a design, you know, just a general overall cluster file system design point of view, I think that is interesting to me.
Right, so in that case, the hypothesis would be that there is a need to change the cluster networking. The networking aspect of the cluster file system protocol, because storage is much faster than before, and so the balance shifts, the bottleneck perhaps shifts to the network. Is that the hypothesis?
Yeah, exactly. Is the bottleneck shifting more to the network? It was always the disk, right? Everyone knows disks are slow, and so having to go over the network that get the disks is now, everyone knows, is slow. But, you know, yeah, is the general management protocol that it takes to assume it's subsuming a bigger time again, and not with the downside of not allowing people to
I guess you need to design an experiment that we can use to evaluate that. Yeah, but that sounds like also another interesting hypothesis to pursue. Right. So how about the parallelism aspect that I'm not sure if the first bullet that you have here not lay out as much, but I'm kind of curious about the parallelism properties of the IO stream and how much caching goes on and what kind of caching inside the storage server, and does any of that need to change because now you have a different device in the back end?
Yeah, that's an interesting one where, depending on how you think about it, I think it could be either just a tuning exercise, or it could be sort of a very interesting sort of set of revelations for the file system community, I guess, you know. In the sense that, for example, with GPFS, because we know disks are slow, and not only that, we know that we have to go over the network to get things, which makes things even slower. There's tons of parallelism and multi-threaded and, you know, basically at any one point you're trying to do a billion things, right? Because you know that if you did anything sequentially, you're just going to sit there for the rest of your life. An example, actually, of that, which actually Flash is helping us with, it was a neglected area. But an example where we didn't fix that is recovery. So today, this is just as an example, recovery, when a node goes down, we have to run the file system log, and that's done sequentially. Basically you run through the log, and every time you find something, you gotta replay it, if that makes sense.
Right.
So this was done sequentially, and from the simple fact that, anyway, there's a long history there, but so what happened there, just as an impact of Flash, is we started putting more things in the recovery log and making it much bigger because we wanted to sort of buffer stuff there, I guess, if that makes sense, like data and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But now, you know, what came out of that was, well, our serial architecture, now that, you know, we're getting into multi-gigabyte size recovery logs, the serial nature of recovery ends up taking a long time. So, because you can end up dying and have gigabytes worth of records that need to be replayed before the file system can consider itself consistent again. So it's kind of that example in the reverse, I guess, right? In that, so that's a good example, and we could go that way, but I was thinking the opposite way in that first bullet point where we have 10, 20, 30, you can tweak everything you can imagine of, hundreds of, you know, read-ahead threads, write-back threads, parallelism of how tokens or like locks are handed out, you name it, right? And it's kind of like, well, and then we also provision X amount of space, like in RAM, for different aspects of the system because, for example, metadata is a very contentious little area. So you want to put tons of it in RAM because to go to disk for metadata is just painful. Whereas now, a lot of that stuff could shift, right? You don't need as much read ahead for the simple fact that you're cluttering up the cache and the effort to go get the data really isn't that painful anymore. The same thing with metadata, and you might be able to scale down a lot of that stuff and actually use the data cache, in RAM cache as, in a different manner, I guess, at this point.
Right.
But I'm not 100% convinced on that one. I don't know what Vasily thinks, but I'm not 100%. It could just end up being a tuning exercise, Or it could end up being kind of like, oh, isn't that interesting? You know, like, we can get all the same performance with less hardware or less memory or less, you know, and end up with some surprising results there.
Right. I think that's one approach, right, where you conduct a bunch of experiments with different knobs set to different points on each of these options, and then you find something interesting, and then you try to crystallize an insight from that data. I'm these days I tend to be a little concerned about that approach because we've gone on too many wild goose chases in the past. I think it would be good to have some hypothesis that we are convinced that it has a level of insight that leads to a publishable unit, and that just requires a little bit more brainstorming up front, I think, but then it can potentially save us a lot of time.
Yeah, definitely, and that's why, like I said, that one is a little more wishy-washy, I think, in terms of, sort of start down this path, and you're not really knowing where you're gonna end up, unless we come up with something more concrete.
Yeah.
So, just again, back from the just going through the list there of the things, I think one thing that I think is interesting that. To me, but maybe it's not interesting to anyone else, is, you know, like I was saying about, so, you know, all flash-based file systems nowadays are moving towards, you know, log structured, right? And so, one thing that I've been thinking about is, you know, this would not really be good for block-based file systems, right, to say that we work at the SCSI level and, you know, in terms of just doing in-place updates and to say that, you know, this design with Flash is really a dead end, you know, or is it a dead end? Or can the FTL layers really, you know, basically save our ass more or less? And I think the general prevailing feeling, correct me if I'm wrong, is that the FTL will save the day.
Yeah, that's the sense I get as well. Talking to, you know, people from Intel and Fusion, they seem to strongly believe that.
So, and in which case, if that's what everyone thinks and then that's what we show, then that's really not interesting.
But I don't think they're talking about the commodity SSDs. They're talking about the enterprise class SSDs.
But I think people also understand that if you use commodity enterprise, then it's also, like, would you agree that that's kind of the prevailing feeling? Is if you have a phone or whatever, you need, you know, JFFS and you need all this stuff. But if you have a violin box or some really nice Fusion I/O or you know, whatever, then, you know, then don't worry about it. Just keep doing what you've been doing.
Yeah.
I'm kind of curious about, I don't know if that's an interesting area to explore in the sense of, it's a, right, because I think that if it came out to say, well, in fact, log-based structured file systems actually, you know, do better even with all the wonderful enhancements, you know, everyone's done.
Well, the only issue with that is that there is optimization going on down there, and log structured file systems have overhead, right? They need to do their garbage cleaning and all of that additional work. And if that's happening already, you may be making things worse by using a log structured file system for certain workloads.
Maybe is that an interesting result? You know, log on log is bad. Don't log your log.
Yeah, and I think if we could run an experiment where we actually disable FTL code and then compare just log structures of raw flash to the regular file system or log structured file system on top of the flash with FTL, then that would be
Right. So there the hypothesis is don't use the log structured, any log structured file system on top of an enterprise class SSD because you're doing more work. You're introducing more work than helping, right?
Yeah, and there's two types of log structures, I guess, right? There's log structured file systems, like you say, which has a lot of cleanup and whatnot inherent in them. And then there's for example, recovery logs, which are just circular buffers.
Yeah.
This is a very minor point, but one thing that I've been also thinking about is then to say, well, so for example, you have data logging. Let's say you have an efficient data log where you can wrap data in a recovery log or whatever, in a sequential fashion, right, in a circular buffer. If you have a flash-based system, does an all flash based system. Now all that means is that you're putting flash in flash, right? Like you would be buffering the data in flash only to then rewrite it back up to flash again because the persistent data store is the same as where the recovery log sits.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense. So the question then becomes though is there a benefit? Does basically recovery logging go out the window? Data logging.
Mm-hmm.
In that sense. I mean, or is there still a benefit, right? If the FDL solved everything, then I would say there's probably no benefit. But if it doesn't, then, you wonder if there's still sort of benefit to doing that. Because today people are saying, you would want to use flash for those kinds of things, persistent data store for the disks, and since they have such different characteristics, then that makes a lot of sense. But anyways, as you can tell, I've kind of been brainstorming a lot, but haven't really narrowed it down yet. So,
right, I think to me, one of the open questions, which is not convincingly answered yet, is, okay, you have disk-based arrays, and you have parallelism because you have multiple disks. The system, the software stack is tuned to exploit the available parallelism. With Flash, the level of parallelism that you have is multiplied because you have, first of all, you have parallelism of the number of devices, but you also have within each device you have several parallel channels or ways or whatever they call it, but then there is this other thing, which is that latencies also are lower. So it's not clear if the existing software stack is already automatically tuning itself, its behavior based on this new set of properties. Maybe it is, but the hypothesis would be, well, it's not, and then the test would be the challenge is coming up with a hypothesis test, right? Is where is the apples to apples comparison here? Right, so you cannot compare disk array performance with flash array performance. Can we do something to extract the most out of the flash for a given workload, bypassing all of the software stack that tries to optimize the access? Right, so I'm struggling with the hypothesis test here, but I think it's an interesting hypothesis to evaluate, at least for me.
Is this different than what I had talked about before in that point one about how
it is? Yeah, it is along those lines. But I'm just trying to crystallize a hypothesis here.
I get,
And but I'm struggling with the hypothesis test, and I'm talking about a single node more than a distributed setting, right?
Yeah. So one thing that, if you don't mind, sort of, it's not confidential or anything, but it just sort of keep it to yourself.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Is there was a guy in IBM who took an NFS server and put it inside GPFS.
Okay.
So he's a smart cookie anyways, and he went off and did this, and so now GPFS could theoretically, this is just a research prototype, theoretically respond to NFS requests directly, right, because it would have a port on when it listened, and then it could do it. And then what he then went off and did was turn off locking. He doesn't go into the kernel.
Mm-hmm.
So when the request comes in, it comes into user space, stays in user space, and basically the entire time. And then he put flash in the back. So he basically turned everything off that makes, you know, makes the system work more or less. But, you know, the interesting thing was that by turning everything off, and he reduced the number of data copies, you know, and he did all this optimization. And then he ended up getting somewhere on the order of 95-98% of the flash box sitting in behind it.
Mm-hmm.
So, it was, you know, with enough threads and things like this. But anyways, it's kind of an interesting point in that, you know, he could tune it, you know, so the existing system today, the theory was that if we turn all this stuff back on, you know, for example, like making sure two threads don't kill each other and corrupt data and all those interesting things, that, you know, that the performance would go down by half or something was our kind of worry.
Right.
But I don't know if this kind of relates, but it's kind of like, you know, you went to that extreme form of tuning and turning things off and everything else. But the interesting question was, that was left was, well, okay, you know, if you put everything back, where would you end? Where would you end up? You know.
So I'm just trying to understand this a little better. So when you say that you put an NFS server into GPFS, so does the NFS server replace the GPFS server then?
Yeah, it becomes one and the same. So normally, you know, you have a Linux NFS server that sits on top of the file system.
Mm-hmm.
You just merge them into a single user space daemon.
I see.
That could respond to network, you know, requests kind of thing.
Okay, and that user space entity talks to raw flash?
Yeah, it talks to raw flash.
I see.
Well, sorry, it talks to a... So IBM has this, bought this company called TMS, Texas Memory Systems.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And so they're now selling these violin-like boxes called Flash Systems. I think they've been rebranded.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, and so it was one of these violin-like boxes in the back of it.
I see.
But I just mentioned it as a point of, you know, it was an interesting data point in that if you do turn off a lot of stuff, you can, you know, sort of achieve. So they were, I think the box can do a million IOPS or something like that, and then this, he was getting, you know, 99% of that or whatever.
Right.
But it was just a data point that it's like, oh, well, it's possible, but, you know, not really, really realistic, right? So what is a realistic number kind of thing?
Well, but I think it's an extremely interesting experiment because basically, you know, if you can select more data points, you can say how every single functionality in such a file system affects, in fact, the performance. And you say, okay, if you want this feature, like locking, you will need to pay this percentage of your raw performance. Then if you want this feature, this is how much you will need to pay in terms of IOPS again. And, you know, having such a distribution, such a split up of performance degradation of, you know, raw hardware to the more fully functional file system, I think it's very interesting.
Yeah, because it will tell you where your bottlenecks are, right? You're spending.
Well, this is.
Yeah.
Right. So this is one thing, and you know, so it's kind of a guide for developers where to focus on.
Mm-hmm.
And second thing is that some people do not need all functionality of the file system. If you're implementing logging in your application, well, if you save within this file system, you will get this amount of performance, and then do it to the application. Or maybe application even doesn't need logging because it's sharing up in cluster or something like that. So this is another way how this information can be used. Yeah, Roger, I also wanted to comment on that, your previous idea on the comparison of, you know, kind of HDD SSD and the parallelism, higher parallelism level in SSD.
Mm-hmm.
So just an idea of how to design an experiment for that. So again, kind of brainstorming here is that if you say, let's say we said that we set the queue length for HDD and for SSD initially to 1, measure the performance for some workload, and then for these same devices, we set the queue unlimited, so to say. So it will be basically defined by the workload which is read, and then we again measure the performance. And then we see how much higher the HDD-based system performance become, and then how much faster SSDs become compared to the queue length 1, right? And then if for HDD is significantly higher, then, okay, that it means that parallelism there is exploited really well. And then in SSDs, we can do something different. If that makes any sense.
Yeah, I do understand what you're saying. I was hoping to, you know, create something that mimics real world workloads, right? So for instance, if we can, so here's the hypothesis that the existing software stack cannot exploit the available performance of all flash arrays. That's the hypothesis, right? So then the test would be given a workload, what is the maximum performance that you can expect from the flash array? And can we construct a test to get that number? And second, run the same workload through the existing software stack sitting on top of a flash array and note the performance. Right, and that would say that okay, the current software stack is either optimal or not, right? But it doesn't say whether the current software stack can be made any better, right?
Yeah.
We still have a follow-up hypothesis to evaluate, you know, what part of the stack can be improved for Flash, right? That question still remains. But
right.
At least we'll have a starting point to say, okay, well, this is a worthwhile set of hypotheses to investigate further. And that was where I was going with the hypothesis test for what
it sounds
yeah.
Kind of like what this guy did though, right? That, you know, he ran it on Flash and he realized, oh, I'm only
yeah.
at 20%. And then
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely,
I think that the description that you gave me seemed that he was coming up with the raw device performance number.
Yeah, exactly. That's what he was doing. I assume, again, this is all kind of like a presentation he gave to us, but it was like, we assume that he measured the raw device and didn't just go by the spec, you know, the vendor spec. But
right.
And then it's a little bit hard to measure, but I think that if you know, he's basically just doing 4K IOs, or I don't know, you know, he's doing something very basic, and then how many can you do in here, and how many can you do there?
Right. Well, you could also, you know, take a trace, let's say a file system trace or a block level trace, anything. Well, file system trace would probably be more appropriate for this hypothesis test, and run it through a file system software stack sitting on top of a flash array, and equivalently run it through without any software, right? Directly map the, you know, whatever file system request to to raw device accesses without any scheduling. So even the scheduler is eliminated, right? And as fast as possible. And that would potentially give some sense for how well you can do with the flash array if you don't do any optimizations at all, versus add in all the things that are already part of the set of things that the software stack does, right? I don't know if you recall, there was this one paper, Flash FIOS or something like that at FAST, where they show that, well, having no scheduler at all is equivalent to having the default Linux scheduler for Flash or something like that. And then eventually they did, create a new IO scheduler. And similarly, people have been saying, okay, well, you need to use log structured file systems for Flash instead of your conventional override-based file systems. But these are all different. They all look at single SSDs, right? They don't look at flash arrays, and some of them look at a commodity and not really look at enterprise. So, and no one really looks at the entire stack. There's these other guys, I think, from San Diego who are doing like poll versus interrupt, or some, I don't know, maybe not San Diego, but said that, okay, well, you should be polling instead of waiting for interrupts and things like that. So all of these seem to indicate that the current software stack is not optimized, would not be optimized for all flash arrays, but it's still at the hypothesis level, because all flash arrays are different than single SSDs. They're different than a single commodity SSD, right? So it's not clear what the answer will be to that question.
So tell me if I'm taking this in a tangent, or if it fits into the same sort of questions. In that, so one interesting phenomenon with sort of enterprise systems is, you instead of having one disk, you have hundreds of disks.
Yeah.
So there's a, just as an example of this, there's a solution paper I just saw today where somebody used one of these flash boxes with GPFS, and they replaced 200 disks with a 2U flash box, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And then performance went up 6x, I think, something along these lines, for their workload, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, that's just a general sort of statement, but the real truth is that if you have hundreds of disks and you have a huge amount of parallelism, the actual random performance of it isn't all that bad, if you know what I mean. You know, and that every individual request, its latency isn't really that great. But in aggregate, because there's so many disks sitting around waiting to do nothing, you know, it actually ends up being, you know, pretty decent, sort of, in terms of the capacity, in terms of the number of IOPS it can provide, if that makes sense. Just because you have so many disks, right? So it's, if you have 100 disks sitting around waiting to do nothing, you can send them 100 requests simultaneously, and it acts as if there had been only one request to one disk, right? It just scales linearly, more or less. So I was just thinking about what you were saying in terms of the tuning, or designed or whatever, you know, the software design. I don't know if it fits in where to say, well, you know, here you're replacing all these disks with SSDs now. And is the system designed for this, A?
Mm-hmm.
But then B, what is the real sort of boost, you know, what is the real, by retuning the system, or by, like you were saying, sort of figuring out what the raw bandwidth is versus what the system's giving you. Sort of, what is the real benefit of this, I guess, is what I'm...
Yeah, I think the hypothesis test is challenging because it's not clear what is the best performance you can extract, because you have this chicken and egg problem, right? Whereas the software stack, the whole goal of the software stack is to optimize access to the device. If you get rid of the software stack, then will you get the best performance or not? So designing this, the hypothesis test is challenging, because we don't know, you know, how to first of all eliminate the software stack and what to expect in terms of performance. One, I mean, we can probably estimate raw performance, but that would be for synthetic workloads, right, which are all, you know, sequential, random. But for real-world workloads, which have burstiness, which have distribution of inter-arrival times and so on, it's not clear whether the stack is well-tuned. I mean, so the list of things that you say here are the caching policies that are going on within the storage server, you know, the prefetching, or the write policies and so on. I mean, are they sufficient? Are they well designed? It's not clear for real world workloads whether that is the case, and how do we evaluate it? It's not clear.
Yeah, I wonder. So along those lines, so Vasily, try to go with me and see if you have any thoughts. Is that you could theoretically, so just looking at GPFS for a second, you could take the 1,000 tunables that are there and scale them all down to like the value 1, more or less, or whatever their minimum value is, and then sort of see. So that, you know, the benefits of all this stuff, you know, the number of read-ahead threads, the number of write-back threads, you know, the number of space for caching, you know, all that stuff, it could be tuned down to the smallest system available and then see what the performance is, you know what I mean? And then you could sort of, kind of like what you were saying before, I'm just trying to think of something manageable instead of actually turning this stuff off, which would be hard. You know, to then scale it up slowly and sort of see, well, we tune down to in order to do this hypothesis you're talking about, we tuned down everything, we turned off, you know, as many optimizations we could, and we're getting, you know, whatever X percentage of the performance without, you know, doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
And then sort of start that as the hypothesis, right? Is that if in the worst tuned system possible, you know, if we could still get 90% of performance, then, you know, what does that say, right?
Hmm.
Yeah. Does that say that all these optimizations are needed because, you know, we're tuning it, we're like anti-tuning.
Hmm.
I'm just trying to come up with a way to destroy the performance and yet show that it may be, you know, like to turn off all these things and then show that. Because I know that, you know, the thought has always been, right, that if network latency was zero and disk latency was zero, then we could chuck 80% of our code out the window. Because we don't need to optimize access to anything. We do everything serially and more or less and, you know, go from there.
Yep. Okay.
I don't know if that would be one way to help, sort of do that hypothesis, is to try to turn off the optimizations and then turn them all on to what we would consider a more ideally tuned system and then show that the benefit really was very minor. Or we show that, in fact, it was incredible and here's why, or something.
Yeah, I think that's a very reasonable thing to do. If there are 1,000 knobs, are there really 1,000 knobs? They're more like 100.
Well, there is and there isn't, you know. It's there's some primary ones, and then you get into the bit twiddling stuff, if you know
yeah.
what I mean.
Yeah.
There's probably, in GPFS anyways, in terms of tuning, there's probably only really about 10 to 20 primary ones that control different cache sizes and, you know, number of threads and things like this. And then beyond that, you get into, then you get into the weeds, which I don't know if we'd want to go there.
Yeah, probably not. So these high-level tunables that you're talking about, they are, they're all, I mean, you can, you're saying you cannot turn them off, but you can turn the dial all the way down. Is that right?
Yeah, some of them you can turn off, and then some of them you could dial down. For example, you still always need a cache. You can't get rid of the data cache. You could run ODirect, I guess, but it's kind of a different code path, if you know what I mean. So you would still probably require some level of this and that, but and you know, certain things, you know, they're well, in general, right? The design is that you read things into memory and then you access them out of memory. So you need to provision some memory space for at least one or two of anything. But yeah, you can dial them down to that, and then theoretically you could dial them up. So one example of that is pre-allocated inodes. So when you create an inode, you know, do you go to, you know, into the metadata subsystem, create it on the disk, read it into memory, you know, initialize its contents, and then, you know, provide it to the user? So that's like a file create. Or do you, one thing that GPFS does is pre-allocate the inode. So you just create a million in memory in advance, and then whenever a file create happens, there's just one sitting right there pre-initialized and ready to go. You just hand it to the guy. Obviously, that's much faster. especially in these disk-based systems, right, where the cost of going to disk and reading in an inode is really, really low, so, or is really high. So one, basically in any kind of NFS workload where you have a high number of files and they're constantly sort of being accessed in various, you know, through multiple threads, at the same time, you want to have a very high count for that value, just so that everything stays in memory. Because as soon as an inode is sort of evicted down to disk and then it's reaccessed, and you got to read it off the disk again. Typically, anyways, with the you know, standard disks, that's a very painful operation. There's, you know, as an extension of that, so one philosophy, again, just sort of brainstorming here, is one philosophy in our department is, so with recovery logs, you know, you can either, let's say you have to do an update in inode, and you have to make sure that it's on disk, or let's say you need to update the block allocation map, right? And then you need to write that to disk to make sure that, you know, it's consistent. So you could either do that, or you can just sort of log the fact that it needs to be done and then put that on disk. And so the amount of work it takes to put something into the recovery log and force that onto a disk is much less work than actually writing and updating the allocation block on disk. Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure.
So the general philosophy is, you know, so when we put a recovery log to disk, we call it saying use the force, right? So we force it to disk. So the philosophy in the department has always been use the force. So anytime you need a little thing done, throw it in the recovery log and force it, because that is like 60 bytes worth of effort versus, you know, possibly multiple IOs to different places on the disk to update the allocation map. So I'm extending the argument to say, is that philosophy still true? You know, is it now, you know, forcing it to the recovery log, all that means is that we've delayed the IO to some later point. And so now we have to do more IOs, whereas if we had just done it because it's so fast to do. Maybe we should have just done it, you know. Anyways, I'm kind of just taking the general concept of that all the optimizations are that are there in the file system today.
And this is specific to GPFS, right? Because other file systems don't have this notion of recovery log.
Well, this is the same log that's in EXT4 or 3. Or...
Are you talking about the journal or?
Yeah, sorry. The journal that helps consistency, right? So,
Okay.
Whatever that thing is that you want to call it, yeah.
Okay. So you're talking about the journal then.
Yeah, sorry. So
but the journaling does atomic, it does atomic transactions.
Well, it is atomic, that's true, but, so maybe there's other benefits there as well, in terms of doing that. I mean, I think that, either way though, right, all those things need to end up on disk in some sort of coherent manner, right? So you journal it, and then in the background, you're updating those pieces individually.
Right.
And you can't leave them in an inconsistent state,
right.
Or at least a corrupt state, anyway.
Right.
But, I guess I was just sort of thinking that we have a departmental philosophy, and I think it's a good one at the moment, that the more you can put in there, the better.
Mm-hmm.
because the amount of work it takes to update stuff synchronously is always, you know, seems to be more than a very small journal record.
Well, there were papers that were claiming that even for XG3 journal helps performance because it basically reduces the number of IO and sequentializes it for a certain period of time. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that I think that's certainly one side effect of using a journal, that you get some sequential performance improvements. But the main purpose of the journal is for correctness, right? Which is when you're updating metadata which are related, you do it as a transaction. The journaling helps with that. So, it seems like the recovery log is more of an optional entity, the way you're describing it to me.
No, well, it's morphed. So it started off as a journal, and it is. I mean, it's all about consistency, but it's about because when the node dies, you have to run the journal, right, or the recovery log.
Yep.
Just like anything else.
Well, and it's not just about. I mean, with journals, it's not just about replaying the journal when the node dies, but also when you're checkpointing transactions, you. Or committing transactions in the journal, there is an atomic property that the journal provides, right?
I mean, it provides such that I guess that until, let's say there's three things need to be done, until all three are done, you leave the record in the journal that if you died, you can then go and update all three things.
That's right.
Again.
Yeah, that is right. Yeah, so, yeah, that's absolutely
right. Yeah, so there's that, you're right, that there's that property.
No.
Yeah, I guess what I was just trying to say though is that in GPFS there is that aspect to it,
mm-hmm.
but as well as it really has turned into more of a way of life in that if at any point you need to update something, what you really should be asking yourself is it quicker to put it in the log and do it later, or is it quicker to do it?
Right.
And in many cases, you know, it can be quicker just to throw things in the log because of several reasons, but there's also a high chance these days that the log will be on SSD, right? And the data will not.
Mm-hmm. I see.
So that's also another point.
Actually, this is an interesting direction, right? Which is, okay, people have looked at log structured file systems for SSDs, but they've not really looked at conventional override based file systems for SSDs. I mean, and how the designs for those class of file systems can be improved for SSDs. I think that's where you're going with this.
Yeah. Well, I think that's where I was kind of going with the FTL comment earlier, right?
Is there
improvements needed? Maybe not, right?
Yeah, and the conventional file systems are optimized for disk drives because, well, the journal helps with the sequentializing and so does the checkpointing because you get to write a lot more in parallel to the disk and write out a sequential stream as opposed to something that's random.
Yeah.
You guys did some
comparisons of file systems on SSDs in that write back paper.
I'm trying to remember. There was JFS and EXT23 and XFS or something like that. XFS.
I think you guys looked at 2.3.4 and ButterFS, I think.
Oh, ButterFS? Hold on. Sorry.
Anyways, it was a couple years ago.
Yeah.
But I know you guys looked at something. I don't quite remember what you took away from it. But.
Okay, let me see. Hold on.
That was around the write back, write through policies.
Right, I do recall that. Yeah. So we had ButterFS, EXT 2, 3, and 4. Yeah, you're absolutely right. So, and I think what we found was okay. So, by the way, this doesn't apply because all these file systems are sitting on a disk drive. And the SSD is just a block level cache. So these file systems are not on top of the SSD. They're in some network storage box. But I don't know if we can take anything away for this line of discussion from
Right. Sorry, I forgot it was only being used as a cache. Yeah.
Mm.
So I don't want to suck up your whole Friday here, but I don't know. Is this something you want to maybe talk more about? Or do you think you have any, sort of extensions of this, or do you have any students you think might be, sort of right for this kind of work? Or
I'm certainly interested in talking more and. I do have a student who's been working with traces. He might be a good fit if we come up with something to work on.
I wouldn't expect it at this stage. I mean, in terms of, before the summer in...
But I think the general...
In May, I think we could definitely narrow it down to a hypothesis, right? That would be the goal.
Okay, yeah, I think we can do that. So... I think we have a good starting point for discussion and there are many interesting questions. By the way, are you guys looking at persistent memory at all or any of that new stuff?
Like flashback DIMMs?
No.
Kind of stuff?
Not flashback DIMMs, but the PCM and the like byte addressable persistent memory. Are you guys looking at any of that stuff or...
there is an Almaden paper, I don't know if you saw, from a guy, Jun, at FAF this year around PCM in storage controllers.
This year, FAST 14?
Yeah, in a few weeks. Not from a file system perspective, but they were looking at it from, sort of how much PCM do they need to sort of, make. They got some early versions from some vendor and they've been looking at sort of how much do you need to basically boost workloads and compared to, other technologies and things like that. I haven't read their paper yet. But.
Yeah, I think I know which one you're talking about.
Yeah.
Okay.
On that note, I talked to Vasily, and I know there's a lot of other people out there now, sort of thinking about how to develop sort of persistent persistent memory-based file systems.
Hmm.
And so I don't know if that's an interest, if that's already sort of a crowded, do you think, I don't know, is that an already a crowded area, or is that, you know, sort of still
Yeah, I think file system for byte-addressable persistent memory may already be crowded, because there's already, you know, this paper from Microsoft, I believe, a few years back, 2009 or something, which I think it's called BPFS or something similar, which, you know, that was the first paper, and I think people just keep referring to that paper for file system for byte-addressable persistent memory. But beyond file systems, other models are still being explored, right? So yeah, that's one line of work. But I mean, I don't want you guys to do something that you guys are not already doing. It's this line of work. This it seems interesting. I think all flash arrays are something interesting. I think we just need to come up with a hypothesis that. You know, what are the differences, right? One is that disk drives are gone, right? So if we lose disk drives, what do we lose? And second is that if you have a much higher degree of parallelism and much lower latencies, what changes, right? I think this area is worth exploring further. I don't think all the questions are answered. So yeah, it's certainly worth exploring.
That is an interesting question, though, even in terms of persistent memory, though, does, you know, what everything we're saying about flash, you know, does that somehow change with persistent memory? I don't.
Right.
That question I haven't thought too much about at the moment, in the sense of, you know, What is the change here, right? Is it effectively the fact that latencies will go down even further? In terms of a performance profile, I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah, one of the things that, you know, if you have byte addressable persistent memory as a cache for flush, and I don't know if that's the right architecture to be looking at, because let's say it is. Then you have a lot less write traffic going to flush, right? Because persistence is provided by memory. So you only see evictions from memory being as opposed to persistence or durability writes going through to flush. So that's one. It's not clear whether, you know, this sort of an assumption, which is PCM as a cache for flash, if it makes sense or not, because if you look at the price points that people are arguing flash PCM would be available at, then there's no place for flash, because PCM is already cheaper and better performant than flash, right?
PCM is?
Yeah, I mean, eventually when it will be, you know, available for...
You think so?
That's what the papers are saying. There's one paper I read. I'm trying to think which one it was. Anyway, he'll come back to me. But that's also the sense that I get from talking to people at Intel who are behind PCM in a very big way, right? And they don't see any room for flash either, eventually. So, well. Anyway, it's not. I mean, given all of these various viewpoints, it's not clear whether an assumption such as PCM as a cache for flash makes sense. But maybe it does. I think we would need to do some projections of cost and performance to see if it makes sense. Thing. Eventually,
well,
we have to sell it, right? We'll have to sell the whole model as a practical
one. One thing I was just going to say that we have looked at is, like I said, these flashback DIMMs.
Mm-hmm.
You know much about?
Yeah, I've heard about them from.
Yeah, so So this is yet another area where we got these roadmaps from vendors about how they were going to sell them, and I don't. That was a year ago, and I haven't heard much of them about them since. So it's kind of been, but they're, you know, they use these super caps to flush the memory and things. So we've started exploring, and we actually are going to have a product this year, probably, cross our fingers, that will use something like that to do as a cache, a form of a cache. It's very small, right? It's a very small amount of memory, but enough to maybe help, you know, boost certain workloads, and then you would put whatever behind it that you would, you know, you could, so it would, could end up being a flash for cache or something like that. So we kind of started down that path, and then our hope, so the thought was then that, like you were saying, in terms of file system or whatever, that we were then saying, well, we should divide a file system that only works in for that, right? So now we're creating byte addressable file systems instead of going through a block device. And then basically the summary of that was, well, we're way too ahead of ourselves because nobody is interested in limiting their file system to the amount of RAM they have. So you need to be able to support, you know, a larger, lower tier. And that's somewhere where we haven't gone down. And actually, that was something. Do you remember Anna Posner?
Yeah.
Yeah. So she left IBM, unfortunately. But this was something we were kind of looking at, or before she left, was, you know, I think that one area where that, you know, becomes interesting is, you know, I've seen a lot of sort of this and that file systems and systems on it, but nothing really that integrates, you know, let's say a byte addressable file system at a top tier with lower level, you know, lower level block based storage. If that makes sense.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. There's this SCMFS paper. I think you talked about. You mentioned it earlier. SCMFS.
Yeah, they do some things. I'm not. I actually can't quite remember. That's what's his name, right? Reddy.
Yeah, Reddy's paper.
I can't quite remember if they integrate the tiering or what they do.
Actually, no, they don't. I'm just looking at the paper. They don't. So the endpoint is the persistent memory. It's not
persistent memory, and that's kind of where we got stuck. Where it was like, well. I mean, at least for IBM anywhere, you know, I mean, for other things, you could imagine TempFS is kind of an interesting starting point to getting yourself into an SCMFS-like system, but then how do you tier properly and do all those other aspects? Could be interesting. I'm still not, that's a thing I'm not 100% sure on.
Okay, so, I know we are way over our time slot. So yeah, I think we should probably have more discussions.
Do you want to, like, would you want us to, you know, would it be worth us talking to, like, any of your students to see if they're interested? Would you want to continue discussions first? What's your kind of...
No, I think we can do that in parallel. Let's see. So I was thinking of one of my students, Ricardo, and probably have him get in touch with you guys with his resume, and then you can look at it. He's fairly early. The reason I'm, you know, I think he might be a potential fit is because he's fairly early in the program. Not too early, but he's still open in terms of direction, and he has some experience with traces and things like that. So, I mean, if you want to do this longer, then having someone who's early in the program helps.
Yeah, definitely.
So, isn't Ricardo Kohler?
No. Ricardo Kohler, he graduated, a year and a half ago, and he's now at VMware.
this guy's name is Ricardo Santana.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but what I'll do is.
Yeah, I remember I met some of your students last FAST, and it was funny. We were joking. They were from, I think, Venezuela, Iran, and Cuba.
Yep. Yep.
It was like the. They were joking. They were the. What's that term, I guess? The
Axis.
Axis, that's the one.
Yeah, I seem to be attracting.
I wonder if you're still able to get government grants here with this student.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a problem. And they, as long as the government doesn't investigate too deeply, I think I'm okay.
Which country is he from?
He's from Venezuela.
Venezuela, okay.
Yeah, Venezuela.
I have to look into that. So I found out this year that I had no idea that we do not hire Iranians.
Oh, okay. But how about Venezuelans?
Well, that's what I have to check. I think it's fine.
Yeah, well, because of what, I mean...
You remember Jorge Guerra? Yeah.
You guys made him an offer, so I mean that can't be possible if you couldn't hire, right? He's from Venezuela too.
Oh, okay, yeah. Then Venezuela is fine.
He's probably okay.
I had no idea. This student I was talking to, he was like, you have to check because I think it's a problem. And I was like, what? I don't believe you. And blah, blah, blah. And I kept telling him I didn't believe him for the longest time until I actually checked. Actually, no, what happened was that Vasily started, and he's Russian.
Yeah.
He's in the non-friendly, but the...
He's not in the axis of evil.
Yeah, it's not. So there's actually a category called terrorist countries.
Uh-huh.
And that's the literal name of it. and you don't want to be in those. And then can't be in an embargoed country. So that would be Cuba. I think there's only one. I have no idea. But they said they can make special cases for special people. But, you know, as a rule of note, unless the person's a genius or there's some, you know, whatever reason to hire them, they won't do it. Blew me away.
Wow, yeah.
But actually, kind of funny thing about that was is that I know so many Iranians, and so I realized, though, that they're all citizens.
That's right, yeah.
Somehow they managed to get citizenship, so I keep forgetting that all the Iranians I know are not from Iran. Like, they are, but, you know.
But they're Americans now. Yep.
They're Americans somehow. I don't know. Yeah. Anyway.
Okay, so...
So please do forward him. That would be good.
Okay, I'll ask him to write to you. And
what about your other... What's the student again that I...
Daniel.
That says it earlier. Yeah, Daniel.
Daniel.
He emailed Jody, and then Jody forwarded his resume around... I guess Jody came and gave a talk there or something. I don't know.
Yeah, Daniel is, I don't know if he would be a good fit because he's, like I said, he's further along in the program and he has already, you know...
Is he looking for a random summer project then or is he looking for...
Something that fits what he's doing. And he's working on basically, I don't know if you... guys saw a paper that we published a couple of years ago in Hot Storage called Non-Blocking Writes.
Oh, yeah.
So that's basically what he's working on. And so anything related to caching, file system caching or memory caching, that sort of stuff would be a good fit for him.
Yeah, that's another interesting... I remember that paper that was over at NFS, right?
We did talk about it. Yeah, one of the things he's doing right now is building it for NFS and so on. Yeah, so
is he extending those techniques then? The other new techniques, or is he just sort of looking for applications of that technique?
We are always always looking for more applications. So if you have any. It would be great to hear about them. But that's his entire PhD thesis. He, you know, he built it all up, and there's a lot more beyond that first paper that we've come up with since then. We're just going conference hopping, right? Trying to get it published in the right place, and he's making lots of improvements. So I don't see him as a very good fit because he's already further along, not for this project, but maybe some other project.
Right.
Because this is too exploratory. But something else, you know, that's more focused might be a better fit for him. Someone who's early enough in the PhD program, this might be a good starting point.
Forward.
I'll ask Ricardo. To send you guys an email.
Yeah, that would be great. Hey, well, thanks for spending the time and brainstorming. Like I said, I know we're not, it's only February is kind of our feeling. We have 3 months to...
Yeah, and we should, you know, set aside some time during FAST to brainstorm more.
Yeah.
I think that would be a good thing. And I'm sure we can come up with something reasonable. It's just the matter of spending time thinking about this more. And now that I have a good sense for what you guys are thinking about, I'll also, you know, do some independent thinking and send out emails if I come up with something, or we can have another chat.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay. That's good.
Any other thoughts, Vasily? Or
no, I think the discussion was really good. So we just let's keep thinking kind of independent with us, and then maybe next week we can meet, and we will also get an email from Ricardo, so maybe we can meet all together and discuss it again. So I think that's the next step.
All right.
Are you in San Jose for the week of FAST?
Actually, I'm there just for the days of FAST. Actually, there are a couple of days where there is lunch, so maybe we could get together on one of those. Lunch may not be the best time for brainstorming. So we could. If you're not particularly interested in one of the sessions, or later on after the end of the day, we could also get together.
Yeah, that'd be good. So you're there Monday to Thursday then, is this specifically?
Yeah. Particularly Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday.
Right.
The Monday
you're
they have...
You're on the Monday.
The Monday they have this NetApp thing that they have every year, so I'm going to that.
So
for me, on Thursday, I'm going to that Linux Storage Summit at Red Hat right after that. So I think basically Tuesday and Wednesday, and on Tuesday I have another meeting in the evening. So Wednesday maybe, if we can think about Wednesday evening, or they have lunch on Wednesday, that is something. That
I
works.
Think there is some lunch on your own stuff, and so we could...
That's only on Wednesday.
That's only on Wednesday. Okay,
yeah.
So either that or sometime during Wednesday, some session that you guys are not interested in as much, and let me know and we can meet during that time.
There's always a couple.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, there is this work in progress on Wednesday. I don't know how interesting is that. And there's also a poster session, and it's, you know, 2 hours, so maybe we can
one
hour at the end of the poster session.
Perfect. Yeah, the only thing is that we should probably get this done before a little bit before the beer starts rolling in, right? And then,
what are you talking about? That's when the good ideas come, you know that.
Yeah, except you can't remember them the next day.
We need a scribe.
Yeah, okay. All right, guys.
All right, have a great weekend.
You too, guys. Thank you.
Talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye.